You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Joan Retallack, an extraordinary American poet, essayist, and scholar, who also happens to be my colleague at Bard College, where she is the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Professor Emerita of Humanities. Joan has taught courses in poetics, poethics, and experimental traditions in the arts, and she was long the director of Bard's Language and Thinking program. She is currently participating in the development of an Arabic Language and Thinking program at Al-Quds University in Abu Dhabi, Palestine. Joan has read and performed her poetry, lectured and participated in conferences, festivals, and invited residencies throughout the world, and her work has been translated into 6 languages. In 2009, her work was the subject of a 2-day conference at Cambridge University, where she delivered the Judith E. Wilson Poetics Lecture. Her interests in poetics include polylingualism, ecopoetics, and the poetics of alterity. In 1996, she received the American Award in Belles Lettres for her marvelous music cage, Cage Muses on Words, Art, Music, John Cage in Conversation with Joan Retallack, which has long been in my top 3 recommended books on John Cage. Her most recent volume of poetry, Boshed, Fables, Moral Tales, and Other Awkward Constructions, came out last year from Litmus Press. Welcome to All Things Cage, Joan. It's a pleasure to see you, even if on Zoom.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Marvelous. Thank you. I want to remind our listening audience that we listened in its entirety last week to Lecture on the Weather by John Cage, which was this incredibly beautiful production we did of it at Bard College in 2007, which was the inaugural year that the John Cage Trust went into residential placement at Bard. Joan is a longtime colleague at Bard College. She was not only one of these stellar performers, along with Jasper Johns and Merce Cunningham and John Ashbery, among many others, but she was the dramaturg, having worked in that same capacity with regard to Lecture on the Weather at least once before that I know of, and maybe more. Joan, maybe speak to that to start us off. You were involved with Lecture on the Weather prior to that production, were you not?
Yeah, I was. I actually first had the delight to be in the audience for a production of Lecture on the Weather that John himself directed, and it was part of his residency at Strathmore Hall that had a major symposium on his work in 1989. And so I was actually, I did not play an active role, but I was there watching him organize it and explain things to people and so on. So that, of course, was a fascinating event in itself. And then the performance had an extraordinary intervention by the weather. Maybe few minutes after it began, there was a clap of thunder that came from outside. And what ensued was one of the most violent thunderstorms that had been experienced in that area, which continued throughout the entire performance of Lecture on the Weather, and which had its own lightning and thunder effects. So the effects were competing with the large scale weather that was just entering the space. So it was an extraordinary experience for all of us. Actually, afterward, I said to John, you caused a lot of trouble with this performance of Lecture on the Weather. There were cars that were floating in the Potomac River because there had been flooding on the edges where, you know, cars usually. So it was quite quite an extraordinary performance. And he loved thinking about his having initiated the lecture on the weather, nature in her own manner of operation, as he liked to say, chimed in. It became a collaboration.
How amazing, amazing. Did you have Marianne Amiche on board with you for the Swarthmore performance?
No, she was not there. The recordings were part of the performance, but she was not there live in the way she mixed her own sound at the Fisher Center. But then I did, after that, I did act as dramaturg for production at Clark University, and in the music department was doing a Stein and Cage festival, Gertrude. And that was really interesting because they really needed, none of them had ever seen it, had been present or heard it. So they were very interested in it, partly because I had written about it and they had read the essay and wanted to do it. And so I got to work with the music director and others, the professor who actually had initiated things, a composer named Linda Dussman. You may or may not know.
D-U-S-S?
No, D-U-S-M-A-N.
Yeah, no.
So at any rate, that was, for me, a marvelous experience because I really had to work with them in figuring out how to stage it. And we ended up with, I mean, these were students doing it. And of course we ended up with tall ladders and students perched on ladders and, you know, the kinds of things that you see in exuberant university performances of various things.
It sounds fun, actually. It sounds visually fun.
It was really fun. It was very much fun. And in that case, because it didn't have to compete with an actual wild thunderstorm going on outside, the lightning, the Thoreau drawings, lightning, and the sound effects really had more of an effect. I mean, you were focused on them in a way that was really lovely. I mean, for Thoreau's little sketches and so on to
which only entered the picture with the thunder toward the end. They only come in when the storm is at its
right.
Which it sounds like you had at Swarthmore it at its peak from the get-go.
Oh yeah, that's right. And again, you know, John always talked about learning from nature's manner of operation. And in fact, he used the word imitating nature's mode of operation. And of course, Lecture on the Weather is composed with that in mind, that the way in which the indeterminacy comes in, the way in which various things happen is actually something that could happen in nature. The only difference, and a big difference, being that when it happens in nature, it's much more sensitive to initial changes in initial conditions, which is what happens with complex dynamics in systems like the weather.
That's exactly right. But in cages, as we know, Lecture on the Weather is beautifully choreographed. You know, it begins with just this rustling breeze and that pitter-patter of rain, and then the rain gets louder and the wind gets more dramatic, and then the thunder starts and then the lightning starts, and then it all kind of fades nicely away. It doesn't do that abrupt here I am kind of thing that storms can do.
So that and then
when was that, Joan? I'm sorry to interrupt. When was that one?
You mean the Clark University one?
The Clark University performance.
I would have to look that up.
Was Cage alive?
It was later. Well, you know, was it after 1992? I'm not sure.
It doesn't matter. I was just curious if he was around or if you were on your own.
You know, I have a feeling it was probably post 1992 because I would have mentioned it to him that I was going to be doing that, of course. So the answer is sometime after 1992.
Fair enough.
And it was in between 1992 and about 1996 or seven, when I was about to be on my way to Bard.
I remember for the Bard performances that we did it twice, as you probably remember, right, back to back. One of the things I remember you doing is at least coaching one person, and that was the president at Bard, who had requested your presence.
Well, he wanted, quote, private lessons in chant operations, end quote.
And you went.
I did. I went to his, it wasn't the first time I had conferred with Leon Botstein in his sort of side porch room. I have to say, did not strike me as fascinated by the role of chance operations, but he did want to understand how to do it correctly.
That's correct. And he did do it beautifully, as I recall. He did it beautifully, and he was positioned on the stage. I think he enjoyed, I want to say, Leon was on one side of him, John Ashbery was on the other side of him, Merce was on the other side of John. So you had these titans all on the left side of the stage, as I remember.
Yeah. Well, how that happened would be interesting to know. Were they all choosing each other to sit next to? No.
Believe it or not, I think it had to do with the wheelchairs, because John Ashbery was in a wheelchair and Merce Cunningham was in a wheelchair. They both had to come in kind of from the same area, and we didn't want to stick them on the end.
I don't know.
And Leon, it seemed appropriate to put over there. I don't know. It just, I think it, that's how that happened. But was there anyone else that you talked to in that way? I don't recall, other than Ari. Do you remember Ari? Maybe I shouldn't even use his name.
Ari
Fenton. Ari was one of the students
I can't remember him, actually.
Oh, there's the most beautiful picture of you and Ari. You're talking in his ear and he's laughing. It's really sweet. It's a beautiful photo. I should send it to you.
Oh, please do.
The issue with Ari, so maybe you weren't involved in this at all, was that he was a theater student. I honestly don't remember. He's long graduated. Mm. But he was oratorical in his presentation. So he was just like, here I am. And I told him, it just really wouldn't work like that. Mm. And, really talked to him about it. And I think we ran it again a little bit, and it was no better. And I asked him to step down. I asked him to step away from the production. That we had an understudy. My partner, actually, Ralph, had been understudying everybody. And, I just suggested that maybe he could do another production with us of something else, but this didn't seem to be his cup of tea. And that snapped him into good behavior. He was perfect after that. And you guys sat next to each other in the production. Send you the picture. He was very handsome, a very handsome young guy. And he turned out to be lovely.
Well, to answer your question about whether I worked with anyone else on chance operations, and also actually the rationale for using them, not just how to. That was in Merce's studio. And remember, we all went, actually not everybody went, but everyone was invited to meet at Merce's studio to work with a dramaturg.
Joan, I had forgotten that until you said it. And that's like, of course.
Yeah. So, just as I forgot about
Benton.
Ari. but that was really nice. I actually, to me, it was very touching and not surprising that Merce was extraordinarily, but not for him, attentive, really taking it very seriously. That was not the case for everyone there, but it was actually, I think, it was a good experience for most of them, because I think there were a lot of people invited to participate who really weren't very familiar with Cage. And I guess you can still almost always say that if you take, you know, a random group of people. Or
yeah, I think I would go further than that and say that most people think that that kind of work, or any Cage piece really, but that one in particular, for some weird reason, it's sort of like anything goes. Like, you really can just read, you know, to your heart's content. You can just do it in real time. You can, all of that, I think. So I think your role was critical, because you were showing them that A, that wasn't true, and B, how to create a score, how to create a disciplined score for them to perform so that they could be free within that structure, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it mostly worked. I do think, interestingly, listening to it, which was very moving for me. I mean, particularly John's preface, as I told you, it always brings tears. There was a buildup where everyone was reading simultaneously that happened briefly, or happened after a rather brief period, that I found registered for me as, uh-oh, they're not, a lot of people are not really observing the silent parts. And of course, John in his instructions talks about the silent parts. I mean, that this is both sound and silence, of course. But I think that some kind of an adrenaline effect that almost becomes a bit competitive, you know, wait, you know, they're all speaking louder and louder, and and it may not be my turn yet, but, and that might be unconscious, on an unconscious level. It struck me as really interesting to think about, well, first of all that John went through with years of performers not quite wanting to, or not quite able to, for one reason or another, go by his very strict timing rules and so on. But it also made me think that were I ever to dramaturg that again, I would actually really build into a rehearsal monitoring the pace.
Right, monitoring the correctness of people adhering to their own scores that they themselves done. Yeah,
right.
No question. You know, it strikes me that it really speaks to the group dynamic of the piece, because you probably have done this yourself, but I remember years ago when I did, for the first time, personally did Lecture on Nothing. And you remember in Cage's Lecture on Nothing, which we've played on this program of Cage, which is very beautiful.
Yeah.
But I remember in that piece, you probably do as well, there's a long silence, very long, about 2/3 of the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the discomfort in my first performance of that piece of just having to sit there and do nothing for what felt like a really long time in front of an audience. And the audience felt my discomfort and in turn was uncomfortable, because she was talking. Why is she not talking now? What's happening? Why is it, you know? And I think that you're quite right that there is, I don't know, competitive may not be right, but this anxiousness to be part of something they're part of. So if six people are reading, that leads six not.
Yeah.
And they want to kind of jump in, you know, they think, it doesn't matter. I can come in 2 minutes early. I can come in 5 minutes early, whatever it is. Of course, we had the opposite problem though, Joan, of people who knew the piece I'm not going to name names, but people timed themselves so that they would come in, you know, they assumed that some famous person was going to start at the beginning and they wanted to dovetail with that person. You
know? Yikes. I wasn't aware of that. I was aware of the, and I'm not going to mention the name, the very charming way in which a certain very genuinely entitled person had been the last voice speaking.
I know exactly what you mean.
We know. We both yeah. know that was. But you know, the fact is,
and by the way, everybody, that was Merce Cunningham.
Oh, all right. I mean,
it's okay. They heard it, you know, and Merce's voice is very distinct. Yes, but it was in an interesting zone that everybody got out of the way. You know, yeah, nobody yeah. tried to upstage him. No one layered on top of him.
Yeah. But one thing I want to say is that the Thoreau texts are beautiful and surprising each time one reads them. And the fact of everybody speaking at once drowns out a good deal of it for a good deal of the time.
That's particularly true if people are not honoring silences.
Yeah, that's right. And that is actually the whole point, honoring the silences.
I agree.
You point out how hard that is as a reader. And I know too, the only way I can do it is to have counted out how long I know the silence should be and then do that counting silently, because my instincts never give me a sense that it's been long enough. So, of course, the other thing is there could have been an intervention with this if I had been paying attention as dramaturg during the rehearsals. But of course, we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time. However, that's important. And then, you know, where the silence is concerned, I think it can help to possibly speak to the audience in advance and just say, you know, this is, there will be silences, and, you know, enjoy it with deep breathing and relaxation.
No question. Although, well, I want to speak to two things you said. One is that one of the ways one can have so stellar a cast is not to require a kind of extended rehearsal period. It's hard to sell that to someone who is traveling to get to you and has a terribly thick schedule. That's one. And the other is, it's a common thing about the silence business. You know, when I haven't done it in a long time, but when I did performances of Indeterminacy with a DJ, I did it one at with Marina Rosenfeld at our John Cage Symposium in, I think it was 2009. And that one I didn't have to deal with this problem at all because I had done it many times. But one of the things that I would tell the DJ, and a reminder to myself, quite frankly, is like, don't be afraid of being quiet. You know, you don't have to play all the time. You don't have to jump in. There can be moments where neither of us is doing a thing. And it's incredibly beautiful. It's restful for the audience. They can reflect on something they just heard. When it comes back, it's fresh. It's so beautiful. Silence is so beautiful.
Yeah.
you're quite right. It could have been something even without extended rehearsal time, now that we've had this experience, that we could have talked about anyway.
You know, even though
they hadn't had that experience, we could have said, don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid of being quiet.
Yeah. Well, one learns from doing things, then realizing retrospectively certain things could have been done better. I hope there will be many more performances of Lecture on the Weather. I think it is one of the great pieces, among so many other great pieces I wish were being performed. And in fact, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
Is there a John Cage festival coming up?
You're talking about for 22 or 23?
Yes.
Nothing actually being planned, Joan, partly because of the havoc that COVID has created in terms of live performance and gatherings. I know that we're coming out of that, but I'd be really, really interested in talking with you about that if you want to.
Yeah, I would love that. Yeah, I think it's about time. The trust has been at Bard for a long time.
The John Cage Trust celebrates its 30th anniversary in 2023. Can you imagine?
I would have had to think and in an incredulous state.
30 years, and Cage's death will be 30 years in next year, 2022. We've initiated some project kind of things, but nothing involving an audience, a live kind of thing. Right. And I'm not averse to doing that. I think we should think about it. It's in the distance enough that we can probably do this. Bard, as you probably well know, Joan, you've been there far longer than I have, it's amenable to our doing really, I won't say wacky things, but unusual things. We can come up with something. We just did a production at Bard this past weekend of Cage's Rotzart mix, where we transformed the house into basically a tape playing machine. You didn't even hear about it.
No.
Yeah, we did that on Saturday.
At the Trust House?
Yes, we transformed Wilson House we had 12 reel-to-reel machines. We had 6 tape players. We had the artist Aaron Dillaway came and curated a new performance of Rotzart Mix. We took some liberties because when Cage did it at Brandeis in 1964, I think it was, the tape loops that were played were brought in by the audience. So people were invited to bring tape loops, which Cage and the other players would splice together and play the piece lasting for hours, only ending when the last audience member left. We didn't do that. Because it was a performance that was celebrating the 10th anniversary of WGXC, the very station that hosts all things Cage, and it's part of
the audience list, because I've had an interview that Chris Funkhauser did with me for that.
He was there. He was not a performer, but he attended.
But I'm so sorry I missed that. Gosh.
Yeah, it was special. Well, check out social media. There's a couple of beautiful videos. There's some audio. There's quite a bit, and we're making, after the fact, obviously, we're making a vinyl recording and we're making a booklet about it. So I'll make sure you get a copy. But anyway, the only reason I'm telling you this is that I remember vividly sitting outside in the huge backyard of Wilson House, which you know well. We have this enormous backyard, which B&G came and cleared nicely for us, took all the weeds and all the stuff away. We had picnic benches and blankets. Sitting out there, I don't know, 2/3 of the way through, and turning to whoever was sitting next to me, a friend, and saying, and I loved it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing. But when I was listening to it, I remember thinking, if I had done this, I would have, he used a chance determined materials from the archives of all the radio programs made by WGXC over the last decade. But I would have, in a nice proportion, have inserted silent loops, because I would have inserted more silence than there was, because it was like a wall of sound, which had its own beauty. It had its own beauty, but I would have, had I been curating it, put more silence into it.
Right. Yeah. Well, Chris isn't into silence.
Well, he was not a player. He was just an audience member.
Oh, okay. I thought that, because he does things like that.
Sure. That's why he came. Anyway, just going back to what you said about silence. Also, the whole ethos of Thoreau and Cage's relationship with Thoreau, it becomes even more important, the invitation to silence, you know, mm-hmm. the allowing silence to be a player, as right. opposed to something which is just not there, except when you're not doing something. You know yeah. what I mean? That it, yeah. And that's a very different aesthetic, isn't it, than most people even think about.
Oh, definitely. I think also that Cage, with this particular piece, wanted the Thoreau language, the Thoreau words, to be heard. In, you know, it would be intermittent, of course, and out of sequence from the book and so on, but the effect of really indistinguishable language for long periods of time because of so many people speaking at once, I think detracts from, or it lessens what could be a very beautiful part of the experience.
I didn't find it disturbing, the way you're speaking of it, but I definitely appreciate what you're saying. Yeah, and people are permitted to create the programs that they create. You know, as you well know, there's this fine line between teaching someone how to do something and then correcting how they did it. You know, it's like,
you do the best you can
in your instruction.
Yeah, we're right. And so at any rate, not, we shouldn't belabor this because it was an extraordinary experience.
I thought so too. I'm moved every time I hear it, and I hadn't heard it in a long time.
Yeah. And I actually found myself, I was listening to it on my computer, and I was holding the speaker on the computer up to my ear, just trying to tease out some of the voices that were being overwhelmed. And some voices were more resonant and, you know, were easier to hear. I heard Merce a lot. I heard actually
Jasper Johns. Yeah.
Yes.
Isn't it beautiful how Jasper starts the piece? That was not planned. I promise you it was not planned.
Yeah.
No, he started reading and everybody else was quiet.
Yes.
For minutes this went on. So that was one of the instances where it's not like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, another experience that I've had with an ensemble doing a Cage piece that requires silence, at least it did for my role, and that was the 46 or 47 minutes for speaker?
45.
45 minutes.
You were close.
Good. I guess I was trying to extend the time for those people. as you know, and you know that piece very well, I think you've performed it.
I performed it right the same time you were performing it. You did it on stage with somebody, and I did it as part of a performance of the 10,000 Things pieces. In the Fisher Center. So we were maybe not the same day, but really close together.
The one I did was with
So Percussion.
That was just fantastic to work with. I loved that, and that was in the Fisher Center, and the audience loved it. Of course, I was silent periodically, and I did my counting thing so that I would really. So as you know, just goes at it, and it, you know, it nonstop, and then it suddenly ended, and I had a lot more to read.
Oops.
So I did. I read it and I observed the silences and so on. And I was a little concerned about that, but I had to. I wasn't going to cut off the language. And I stopped. And the audience rose up with an ovation, which of course was everything. At least I didn't do any harm. They didn't.
Oh, Joan, I would venture a guess that they rose up because it was such a relief to just hear 45 minutes for a speaker for a bit. You know what I mean?
I don't know. No, but it was really quite something. I mean, if I could have been holding my breath as I was speaking and observing these silences where I was sort of holding my breath, I would have been doing that. But the audience was just totally silent. And it was, I don't know, it was an accidental addition.
Elongation.
Which I think, I mean, afterwards, a lot of people said that they of course love soap percussion, and they also really loved the text that John had composed. So it was a great experience.
There were many other performers involved in that production, as I recall. The fellow from Bangin' a Can was there. David Lang was performing in that program. There were a lot of pieces going on.
Musicians. Yeah, there were a lot. And actually also a violinist on the Erica.
Oh, Erica Kiesewetter.
Yeah. I forget who the pianist was. Yeah, the stage was just filled.
It was a big deal. It was part of their ongoing series. They did that at Carnegie, I think, a month later or a month earlier. Yeah. They were doing that program. So it was a very big deal. I just remember you and I were learning it at the same time.
Right.
So we're dangerously running out of time. And I want to talk a little bit about your work. I mean, you are an internationally recognized poet. You've done some amazing books on poetry, but also sort of critical books. You did one of Jasper Johns's favorite books on Cage, which was Music Cage. Cage muses on words, art, music, words, whatever the order is. That was by his bedside for a long time. And he told me he just loved it. It was so smart. So I don't know that we wanted to have time to talk about that book too much, but something rather that would maybe speak to what the influence of Cage has been in your work, or what how it's touched the direction of your work over the years. When did you meet Cage first? Do you recall?
Yeah, I definitely recall. It was in 1965 at the Harper Theater in Hyde Park in Chicago, where the company was there performing. There was a dance series, and the Cunningham and Cage, well, it was Cunningham. Cage wasn't mentioned as part of the title at that time. And I interested in dance, had a lot of dancer friends and went to a lot of rehearsals. And I had been hearing about Cunningham for a long time. So I went. I was astonished by what I was seeing. David Tudor was there with John. They were both preparing the piano. I mean, it was, I won't go into the whole program. It was the extraordinary group with Carolyn Brown being the partner for Cage and so much. Cunningham.
Yeah, partner for Cunningham. So
Cunningham, much. Yes.
Right. I didn't want people to think that Cage stopped dancing in 65.
No, right. Right. Thank you. That was an important correction.
You know, Merce once said that John had heightened senses, but he had no kinesthetic sense. None. I don't think that's true, but.
So anyway, this is about meeting John. So it was extraordinary. John read the Indeterminacy piece while smoking and drinking champagne. It was amazing. So, but what struck me along with everything else was that something had happened to my sense of time as I was watching these things happen. And it had to do with the asynchronous movement and music I sort of realized that then, but I really wanted to know what had happened. You know, it was just oh my God, this is the most incredible thing I have ever seen in a theater. What just happened? So I brazenly, actually, and lots of people were leaving, tossing epithets over their shoulder. These were the early days when this incredible work was being done and people were scornful of it. They, you know, it wasn't what they'd expected. At any rate, I went backstage. It's something I was used to doing because I did a lot of performance, stage performance, as when I was a teenager, and theater stuff. And I bumped into Merce. I was hoping there'd be some, you know, anonymous person, like a stage manager or something, to ask the question, which I did of Merce, do you by some chance rehearse in the afternoons, or, you know, do the dancers do exercises and so on in the theater? And if so, I'm so intrigued by what I saw and I really want to know more about it. I would love to just sit in the back of the auditorium and watch. And Merce was lovely. He was smiling. He said, "You're welcome to come, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed it," and so on. So the next day I came, he told me when the rehearsals started, they weren't really rehearsals, but warm-ups and various things. And I arrived and there was one person in the auditorium toward the front, and I realized that was John Cage. So I just quietly sat down. He had heard me come in. He got up and came over and said, "Why don't you come closer to the stage? You can sit next to me." And we started talking. I mean, he asked me, you know, in quiet voices, he asked me who I was and what was I doing in Chicago. And what I was doing at the time was at the University of Chicago. And that I then came back every day for the time that they were there, and we continued our conversations, which were about philosophy and art.
Lovely, lovely. So ends part one of All Things Cage with Joan Retallack, which will continue with part two next week, a program to be devoted to Joan's writings. Our conversation will focus on how she has been influenced by Cage and about how her own work has reflected this influence over what has been many, many years. I can think of no other poet who has carried forward the aesthetic of John Cage in a more personal, beautiful, and evocative way. For now, let's listen to something by Cage that evokes for me something of Joan's work. A lengthy excerpt from his Hymns and Variations from 1979 for 12 amplified voices, as it appears on the Mode CD Cage Edition 18, entitled The Choral Works 1, performed by the extraordinary vocal ensemble Ars Nova, Tomas Vito conducting. Hymns and Variations is Cage's largest choral work, starting with two hymns by the colonial American composer William Billings. Cage then used a compositional technique he called harmonic subtraction to produce a sublime series of long overlapping tones with lots of empty spaces in the variations 1 through 10 that follow. This is one of my very favorite of Mode's CDs. Each rendition of Cage's works it contains more and more wonderful. A revelatory recording that is, unfortunately, out of stock.
Thank you. preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.